But I went down to meet with some 30 pastors from large churches all over the country. And it was an excellent, thrilling time. We had with us Peter Drucker, who's one of the experts on management in businesses around the country, and he gave us some comments on the organization. But largely it was a discussion of how to minister to people. You know, there's a new phenomenon rising in America, and that is an abundance of mega churches, huge churches. A church of 2,000 or 3,000 is now just a moderate-sized church. Although when I was a boy, a church of 3,000 or 4,000 members was considered just a tremendously large church. But now there are dozens of them. And among the churches that were represented at this conference, there were some that were where they had 10,000 or more every Sunday to minister to on Sunday morning, and several of that size. One had 3,500 people coming on Wednesday evening, most of them untouched pagans that had not been in church much before, and it was exciting to see how God is working in that way. Among these 30 pastors, there were many differences of temperament. Some were young, some were old. Some were tall, some were short, some were outgoing in personality, some rather retiring. But one thing that was very clear that came through the whole conference was a deep underlying concern for people. These were real pastors. They were shepherds, and they had the flock in mind. Now, when we turn to the second chapter of 1 Thessalonians this morning, you see something like that out of the early church. Paul is writing back to this church that he had founded in the city of Thessalonica, and there comes out of this whole section, the first 12 verses of the chapter, just a marvelous sense of his deep concern for the development of these people. Here's a master shepherd at work. And this provides a great model for ministry. I think there's no doubt that he's defending himself a bit from some criticisms that had arisen after he had left. Obviously, some of the people of the city were trying to accuse him of various motives for his ministry, and he's answering that. But as you read this, there emerges just a wonderful sense of how a good shepherd works. Now, I know some of you are probably thinking, well, how does that apply to me? You pastors, you're a special breed anyway. You know, peculiar people. But ordinary people like us, how do we get in on this? What does this say to us? One of the young pastors down there commented. He said, you know, Jesus was so human that nobody would believe he was God. But we pastors are so godlike, nobody thinks we're human. And there's some truth to that. But I want to point out and remind you of a truth that we've talked about a lot here, and that is every believer is in the ministry. We all have pastoral responsibilities. If you're a parent, you've got a little flock at home, and you're to minister to them. And if you want to minister effectively, you can learn from this passage how to do that. And you've got friends that you meet with. Some of you are meeting in breakfast groups, some in luncheon groups. Some have a Bible class in your home, a small group meeting. And that's a flock. And this teaches us how to be effective in ministry with people, how to touch and change people. Now, the first six verses reflect this, I think, one of the primary qualities that it takes to be a good shepherd. Paul says, "For you yourselves know, brethren, that our visit to you was not in vain." That is, it was effective. He left a church there. And all his detractors were trying to suggest that he had come and wasted his time. But Paul says, no, it was not. It was effective. And this is why. He says, though we had already suffered and been shamefully treated at Philippi, as you know, we had courage in our God to declare to you the gospel of God in the face of great opposition. Courage. See, that's the first mark, I think, of an essential for helping somebody else. There are times when it's hard to talk to someone. Have you found that out? When it's difficult to bring up a subject that needs to be discussed. People are sensitive. They're touchy. They don't like to be reminded of certain things. And it's difficult. Takes courage to speak. Now, Paul, of course, was talking about physical courage here. When you read the account of his time at Philippi, you can see that he says of himself here, that he had been shamefully treated and had suffered there, is really an understatement. If you recall that account, he had been thrown into prison. He had been beaten with rods, one of the first of three times that the apostle was actually subjected to the Roman form of punishment of being beaten with thick sticks, and then thrown into prison, and even in prison thrust into stocks where he and Silas were held immobile and couldn't move their arms or legs, and sitting there in the midst of the prison, locked up like that, they began to sing praises unto God. It's a great story. And yet, and beyond that, he had been insulted. He'd been actually stripped of his clothes in public by order of the magistrates there. He had been mocked. His Roman citizenship had been ignored. Nobody had bothered to ask whether he was a citizen or not. And even when he was freed, he was summarily, rather cavalierly, ordered out of town by the authorities. And yet, he went on. He came on to Thessalonica, knowing that the same kind of thing would happen here as well. And you can't read the life of Paul without seeing something of the tremendous courage that he demonstrated. In the riot in Ephesus that broke out, recorded in Acts, he actually tried to face down a howling mob who were bent on his life and had to be restrained by his friends to keep from sacrificing himself to the mob's fury. Now, how do you explain courage like that? What's the answer to it? A lot of us say, well, Paul was that by nature. He was fearless. You read about him and he'd take on anything. But certain verses indicate that wasn't true. He was just like you and me. He tells us that when he came into Corinth and began to preach, he did so with much fear and trembling. And he was scared inside. Corinth intimidated him. And some of us who have to reach out to our fellow workers at work, feel intimidated at times. We're in a pagan atmosphere, and Paul felt that very strongly. He tells us about Ephesus that he puts it, there were fightings without and fears within. And as you read that, you can see that he's like most of us. By nature, I'm a devout coward. And the few times of my life that I've shown courage, I have to say, were simply by the grace of God at work. Now, Paul tells us here what lay behind his courage. In these next verses, verse 3 and on, he puts it very clearly, both negatively and positively. First, he says, our appeal does not spring from error or uncleanness, nor is it made with guile. But just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak. Not to please men, but to please God who tests our hearts. For we never used either words of flattery, as you know, or a cloak for greed, as God is witness, nor did we seek glory from men, whether from you or from others, though we might have made demands as apostles of Christ. Now, there are some very wrong reasons for boldness. There are a lot of people that can appear to be courageous and bold, but they're for the wrong reasons. Paul lists them here. First, he says, we didn't come out of error or uncleanness. That is, we didn't come peddling some particular private revelation that we had. As you know, today we're constantly confronted with a parade of gurus and prophets and seers and avatars and other people claiming to be able to tell us what the truth is and peddling a particular form of doctrine. And they appear to be bold and courageous, and they confront us on every side, and it looks like it's driven by conviction. And perhaps in some degree it is, but it's wrong conviction. You go to an airport, and you're probably going to be confronted with a couple of people trying to sell you flowers, the Moonies, under the leadership of Sun Myung Moon, who claims to be the Messiah and boldly peddles his doctrine across the state and around the world. And there are others of that sort. But Paul says, we didn't come that way. We didn't come peddling any private doctrine. Nor did we come inviting people to sexual license. You can get a big crowd and a big following that way today. If you encourage people to just indulge themselves sexually, throw over all the bonds and do whatever they like, you can get a big crowd. Look at Jim Jones up in San Francisco and the Bhagwan Shri in that commune up in Oregon, where they indulged in widespread sexual orgies and people flocked there, attracted by that kind of teaching. But Paul denies that. He says, this is not part of ours. Nor was it guile or flattery or greed. I appreciate his words along that line. So many teachers today on television and elsewhere are appealing to our ego, to the macho instinct in us. There's a fellow comes on television who many of you have heard, I'm sure, wears a crazy hat, smokes a cigar, orders people around, demands they send him money, manifests all every indication of just sheer ego, and covers it over with an attempt to be a teacher of the Word. What he's teaching has a great deal of truth about it, but mixed with a great deal of error. And many people follow that kind of thing. He appears to be bold and uncompromising. And I can name people right around here that have succumbed to that kind of an appeal. There are people who make a promise of prosperity, of getting you rich if you follow them. And Paul says, it wasn't that with me. We didn't come with a cloak for our greed. What a description that is of much that you hear on television today. I have a friend down in Houston, Texas, a very brilliant businessman. He's a great Bible teacher. He teaches a Sunday school class. And preparing to teach his class, he got to thinking the other day about how you'd relate to God if this prosperity theology were true. And so he jotted down some of his thoughts, and having this kind of a mind, he put it into rhyme. And he sent me a copy. I want to share it with you. It's called An Offer God Couldn't Refuse. You know, God, I've been thinking, and I hope that I'm not wrong. I think I got it figured out how we can get along. There are certain things you got to have and things that I need, too. So I got a proposition. Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm reading in the paper here that things ain't going great. The dollar's down, the yen is up, and some of us can't wait to get the next edition of the Journal or the Post to see which market overseas last night has fallen most. Now, certain friends have told me you got troubles with your game, with Jimmy and with Tammy and some others I won't name. And the things that I am hearing and the word all over town is that your overhead is up while your income's coming down. I don't mean no disrespect. I hope I don't sound brash. But with the praise and glory, I think you could use some cash. So I got this little acreage in the Gulf of Mexico. I'm sure there's oil there somewhere, but just where, I do not know. So here's what you can do for me within your sovereign will. Send a vision. Send a sign. Just show me where to drill. Then, when the oil comes gushing in, you ready for a laugh? Some might offer 10%, but I'll cut you in for half. But wait, it just occurred to me this deal will be a mess. Where should I send your money? I don't have your home address. But no, I have the answer, and you'll like it, I'm sure. Do you remember how much dough the Pope spent on his tour? It set the cardinals sighing, and it made the bishops groan. It cost about $1 million for a day in San Antonio. And if that was the figure for a day of papal drumming, we'd better lay the groundwork now for Jesus' second coming. So I'll just keep your share, dear Lord. And it will be just fine until sweet Jesus needs it, Lord. I'll just pretend it's mine. Well, that's pretty accurate theology, isn't it? That's what you hear on so many sides today, a cloak for greed. Paul says, we didn't do that. We didn't want your money. As we'll see in a little bit, he refused to let them support him in any way. He came just intent on giving them something that they desperately needed. And finally, he says negatively, we didn't come to seek fame or status in the eyes of men. In verse 6, nor did we seek glory from men, whether from you or from others, though we might have made demands as apostles of Christ. He had the position, he had the authority as an authorized spokesman of Jesus that he could have played upon, but he didn't. He didn't want anything for himself. He didn't slant his message to appeal to the popular mind. He didn't leave out some of the scripture. He didn't slur over some of the unpleasant aspects of the truth. He was honest and faithful, and he ministered to them regardless of whether he received any praise or glory or thanks for it. Well then, what did motivate him? What does produce courage? Well, he tells us in verse 4, one verse, just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak, not to please men, but to please God who tests our hearts. That's a wonderful verse. There are two things in it that motivated Paul. One, he says he is intensely grateful for the honor of proclaiming the good news about God, the gospel of God. Four times in these verses, he speaks of the gospel. You have it in verse 2, you have it in verse 4, you have it again in verse 8, and again in verse 9. Four times. He gloried in the fact that God had called him to deliver a message that people desperately needed. I don't know if you run into it, though I'm sure you do. All the heartache, the heartbreak of life around us, the loneliness, the misery, the agony, the sheer agony of spirit that people live in day after day all around us. Why? Because they don't know the truth about God. They don't know the delivering power of Jesus Christ. They don't know the warmth, the inner warmth and strength and encouragement that can come from Christ living in them. And God has committed that message to us that we might give it to them. What an honor that is. I want to tell you, in all my years of preaching, there's nothing that intrigues me more and encourages me more than to remind myself that I have already been given the greatest honor that can ever be given to a human being, to proclaim the what Paul calls the unsearchable riches of Christ. Could there be anything greater than that? Well, Paul felt this way. He said, everywhere, he just considers himself an extremely fortunate person that he is given this fantastic message to speak. And more than that, he says he is motivated by a desire to please God. Now, I want to tell you, the only way you want to please God is because you've learned to love Him. You don't really try to please God if you haven't loved God. You may try to get something from God for yourself, and that's a motive in many people's lives. But if you want to really please God, if that's a strong impelling force within you, it's because you've learned that God already loves you. That's why we sing so many hymns that speak about the love of God for us. And every Christian ought to look back continually, as we did a moment ago at this communion table, to that fantastic deed when on Christ almighty vengeance fell that would have sunk a world to hell. He bore it for a chosen race and thus became our hiding place. See? The love of God means that we want to please Him. This was Jesus' motive. He said many times, I do always those things which please my Father. Not because He wanted something from God. He could have had anything. But because He loved Him and wanted to please Him. You remember how Peter, bold, blustery Peter, felt this so powerfully when he met with the Lord after the resurrection by the Sea of Galilee. And Jesus asked him those three times that searching question, Peter, do you love me? And all Peter can finally say is, Lord, you know that I love you. That's what held him in the moment of his disobedience and his weakness. That's what brought him back. He knew that he loved him. Now, that's the wellspring of courage. If you need courage in your life, don't try to bolster it up and force yourself. Begin to think about the love of God. Begin to think about the honor of walking with Him and of speaking of the truth to others. And you'll soon find yourself driven, motivated. As Paul puts it in 2 Corinthians, the love of Christ compels me. That's the secret of his courageous activity. Now you have a second quality of a good shepherd in verses 7 through 9. He says, but we were gentle among you, like a nurse taking care of her children, literally a nursing mother ministering, feeding her children. So being affectionately desirous of you, we were ready to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves, because you had become very dear to us. For you remember our labor and toil, brethren. We worked night and day that we might not burden any of you while we preached to you the gospel of God. I think you can only describe that as sensitive love. A love deeply desirous of blessing somebody and finding gentle, tender ways of communicating that. Perhaps this is the first manifestation of love, is to learn to do it gently. You know, love often has to be strong. It has to be tough. It has to rebuke. But it has to learn how to do it gently. And that's what Paul said he did. He came among them as a nursing mother feeding her children, just delighted to minister to their need. When I was a young Christian, I came under the ministry of Dawson Trotman. He was the one who founded the Navigators. Dawson was a strong personality. He could be demanding. He was self-disciplined to an enormous degree. And he expected it of those who worked with him. And today, that has marked the Navigator ministry wherever they are. But when I would meet with Dawson individually, he always was gentle. He always spoke directly to me and seemed aware of my need and of my capacity. And I've appreciated that about him. I often think of him in connection as being something like the Apostle Paul. For Paul could be stern and sharp, but when he was with somebody alone, he was gentle. And that's a mark of a true shepherd. There's a second manifestation here he mentions. He says, being affectionately desirous of you. That's an unusual phrase. You don't find that often in Scripture. Literally, it means a yearning, a longing for you. I have to tell you, I've felt this often as a pastor here. I stand talking to a young person and I feel my heart longing to help them, to bless them, to teach them, to lead them, to fulfill them. I'm sure you feel that way with your own children. There's a yearning after them, of an affectionate desire to see them blossom and grow and go the right direction. And that's characteristic of those who seek to minister to others. And still a third mark of a loving spirit here in verse 9. You remember our labor and toil, brethren. We worked night and day that we might not burden any of you. Hard work, a willingness to work hard, is a sign of a true shepherd, of a true pastor. Paul, as you know, was a tent maker. Every Jewish boy had to learn a trade, and his was tent making. And rather than take offerings from his new converts to support himself, he made tents at night. He had to do it at night. He taught during the day. He worked long hours into the night. And I can imagine that these Thessalonians, as they listened to Paul teaching them and instructing them during the daytime, watched his hands and saw that they weren't the cultured, soft hands of some rich person who had never worked hard, but the hard, horny hands of a laborer who worked hard at what he was doing in order that he might bless their hearts. I often think of my wife's hands. She thinks they're ugly because they're not as smooth and soft as they once were. And all the creams and lotions don't live up to their promises, I tell you today. But they're beautiful to me because they represent self-sacrificing labor, long hours in the dishpan and working out, mopping floors and doing other things that are hard on hands. And sure, they're not as beautiful as some of the ones you see on television, but they're beautiful to me because they represent hard work, dedicated work that is a manifestation of a loving heart. And finally, as a third quality here, and most important, In verses 10 to 12, you have faithfulness. You are witnesses and God also. How holy and righteous and blameless was our behavior to you believers. For you know how, like a father with his children, we exhorted each one of you and encouraged you and charged you to lead a life worthy of God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. There's a modern term for that that I think expresses it accurately. It's the word integrity. This is in short supply today in Christian circles. So many places you find leaders and pastors in the electronic church, this is very visible, who lack integrity, whose own lives are a mess, and yet who are seeking to try to help somebody else, and it never can be done. But look at Paul. He says, our own life was right. We were holy and righteous and blameless. Now, a lot of people think Paul is a egotistic boaster, that he is claiming things that he had no right to claim. But everywhere that Paul mentions this sort of thing, he makes clear that he isn't responsible for this. This isn't him by nature. This is the grace of God at work in him. It's God who made him holy. Paul didn't make himself holy. Holiness means separate, marked out for a single purpose, single-minded would be a good translation of it in this sense. There's the Old Testament speaks of the beauty of holiness, of somebody who sees who he belongs to, and that satisfies his heart. Paul was that way toward God. And he was righteous before others. He behaved himself. He watched his conduct. He resisted things that would mislead or that others could misconstrue. He says himself, if my drinking wine or eating meat is going to offend somebody, I won't touch it again. He was righteous in his behavior. And finally, he's blameless in his own eyes. Now, don't misunderstand that. Blamelessness in Scripture, it never means sinless. Paul didn't think of himself as sinless. What he means is he's honest. He's dealt with his sin. Aware of it, he judges it. He does something about it. He doesn't just cover it over. Because, as he puts it, God tests the heart. He knows what's going on. And Paul is strictly honest with himself. These young pastors that I met with, one of them particularly intrigued me. We met in small groups and began to discuss and share with one another what were the ways we kept ourselves vital and spiritually alive. And I was in his group. He's only 35 years old, but he ministers to 10,500 people or more every Sunday morning. And I was interested in what he said about how he maintains his spiritual capacity. He says every morning, he sits at his desk and he takes a piece of paper and he writes across the top of it the letters A, C, T, and S. Some of you know of this method. It's a good one. I pass it on to you for any help it may give any of you. The A stands for adoration, C, confession, T, thanksgiving, and S, supplication. And then he takes his pen and he writes down all the things he can think of about the majesty and the greatness and the glory of God. He does what Jesus teaches us in the Lord's Prayer, to turn your thoughts to God first. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. And he begins to contemplate the majesty of God, the greatness of his being, the love of his heart, the mercy that he has manifested toward us, and list those qualities. That's what the psalmist does, you remember? Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits. All that is within me, bless ye the Lord. And then he turns to confession, and he said, I begin to write down the sins that I'm aware of that I did yesterday. He said, if it's Monday morning, and I, in my preaching, I exaggerated in an illustration. I said it was a 9-car pileup when it was only a 6-car pileup. He said, I write down. I don't write down I exaggerated. He said, I lied to the people. And if I inadvertently kept some change, that the wrong change that was given to me, he said, I don't write down. I kept some money that wasn't mine. He said, I stole some money yesterday. He said, I want to be hard on myself. I want to put it down in the worst possible way so I'll face it in myself, these tendencies. And then he said, I turned to thanksgiving and I begin to give thanks that I'm forgiven these things. And one by one, I cross them out, forgiven, forgiven. And then supplication, I begin to pray, ask God for the strength not to be like that anymore, but to be honest and careful and thoughtful. No wonder that young man is being greatly used of God. And my heart just leaped up that a young preacher would have that kind of integrity about him. That's what you see here in Paul. He's honest, thoroughly, ruthlessly honest. Now, from that base of a faithful personal life, he does three things, he said, for the Thessalonians. He exhorted them, he encouraged them, and he charged them. That is, he challenged them. We all have to do that. Exhortation usually takes the form of a rebuke. I'm a father, and as I look back upon my children growing up, there were times when I had to sit down with them and say, look, you're headed for trouble. If you go down the path you're headed down now, you're going to hurt yourself and hurt your family. You're going to destroy things of value in your life. You're headed for trouble. And a father has to do that. And so does a pastor sometimes. So do you if you want to help somebody, minister to their need. But along with that, there should be encouragement and challenge. I have to confess, as I look back on my relationships with my children, there was not enough of encouragement. Encouragement that says, you're doing better. I can see changes. You're going to make it. I'm with you. I'm behind you. Keep on. And pointing out the positive values of things. And I have to confess with sadness, there was all too little of challenge, of saying to them, you're meant for better things. You don't have to live like this. You're capable of more. There are great possibilities before you. God's leading you and calling you and urging you to lay hold of those. That's what Paul did here. He pointed out that it's God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. There are great possibilities for all of us in this hour of history, facing the crisis in world affairs. We can encourage each other that this is an hour of great importance. This is the time, these are the times that try men's souls. And they're hours of danger and of crisis, but also great possibility. What a challenge to live like that today. And as I look through this record and see these three marks of a faithful shepherd, courage, loving, gentle heart, and a faithful spirit, I have to pray, and I hope you're praying too, Lord, do it again. Do it in my life. Make me a man who is a blessing in my own time. And I hope your prayer is that as well. We're going to conclude now this morning by asking you just to rise and receive a benediction, and then we'll be through. Let's stand together. Now may the Lord bless you and keep you and make His face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you and lift up His countenance upon you and give you peace.